people are roughly twice as likely to do the occupation that was historically associated with their caste than something else. These traditional occupations have a kind of coordinating role in the economy.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. India's caste system is about far more than just social hierarchy. Your caste also traditionally determined your occupation as well. In modern India, does caste still influence which job someone will choose? And if it does, what's the effect of this on India's labour market and on its economy? Daniel Keniston of Louisiana State University is one of a team that has analysed the impact of caste on work and on hierarchy. And he joins me now. Dan, welcome.
Thanks, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dan, explain how intricate the caste system is in India. What sort of occupations does it represent? How many castes are there?
Well, India has thousands, at least 3,000 of what are called jatis. Jatis are sometimes called subcastes, although that term is a bit complicated. But historically, each jati would have one or maybe a couple traditional occupations that were associated with that jati. Now, it's controversial how far back these traditional occupations go, whether 1,000 years ago, the same jati would have been doing the same occupation that they would have been doing 100 years ago. But for sure, at least 100 years ago, these traditional occupations became very associated with each particular jati. And to this day, those same associations between members of a jati and the traditional occupation that was sort of culturally linked to that jati, at least 100 years ago, seem to persist.
And as you say, this system is very long-standing. So has it been enforced by laws or quotas or some kind of discrimination or some other process? What keeps it in place?
Well, that's a great question. It's one that anthropologists and economists and sociologists have debated a lot. Certainly, historically, there was explicit discrimination against members of the lower castes. And in some cases, there were rules requiring certain jobs be done by members of certain jatis. But I think the thing that's most striking is that historically, and even more today, the links between caste and occupations weren't official legal links. They were cultural links. They were identity links that members of a certain caste felt tied to a certain occupation or potentially discriminated against if they were to attempt to work in an alternative occupation.
So in 2021, today, how much more likely is a caste member to work in that caste's traditional occupation rather than some other job?
Well, there's a few different ways of looking at that. So one thing I can tell you, for example, is that for men in India, there are about 17 or 18% of them work in the traditional occupation that is associated with their caste. And if we were to just randomly assign people to various occupations, that number would be about 9%. So men are about twice as likely. Women aren't as involved in the labor force as men in India, but for women, the numbers are about 8% in traditional occupations versus 5%. Now, another way to look at it is how much more likely are you to do your traditional occupation than just any random occupation? And the number is about twice as likely. So people are roughly twice as likely to do the occupation that was historically associated with their caste than something else.
If we think of this as some kind of labor market friction or something, does this mean that those workers are earning less than they could do given their abilities or their qualification or their schooling?
That's a great question. And, you know, that was what we originally thought going into this paper. But it turns out that the situation is actually much more complicated. And it's because there's really two ways that you can imagine that workers select into their traditional occupation. So in one kind of vision of the world, the only workers who are doing their traditional occupation are the ones who don't have the initiative or enterprise to get out and go to Bangalore and start working for Google or something like that. And so in that vision, you know, you might imagine that hypothetically, if we looked at the people who are doing their traditional occupation versus those who have entered that occupation, that is, as outsiders, you might imagine the outsiders would be earning more. But what we found that's very surprising is that the workers who are doing their traditional occupation actually earn more in that occupation than the outsiders. So, for example, a traditional baker or a traditional farmer, on average, earns more in the baking occupation or the farming occupation than someone who has entered that occupation for whom it was not traditional. So the way we try to explain that is that the presence of a traditional occupation, the appeal of a traditional occupation, incentivizes or encourages some workers to remain in their traditional occupation who would otherwise have gone off to join another higher returns occupation. So, you know, there may be some people who are just geniuses who are traditionally bakers. Perhaps if it wasn't for those ties to the baking occupation that they feel, they would be off working for Google in Bangalore or being teachers or doctors or some occupation that gives a very high return to that skill. But because they feel this tie with their ancestral job, they remain in baking. And they are, in fact, very successful in baking because they're taking all that skill that they have and they're applying it to their traditional occupation. But of course, the only reason they're doing that is because it is their traditional occupation.
And so how do we think of these ties? What's the advantage to the worker that compensates for not going to Bangalore?
We think of it as operating through a variety of different means. So on the most basic level, we think that there's a sense of identity, a sense of doing the job that is historically right for you and for your caste. Or potentially, we could also see that as discrimination, that you know there might be some discouragement from society for doing a job that is not right for you. So we can't distinguish between a positive tie versus a negative discrimination in other fields. Although I must say that other research, there's some very interesting paper by Suwana Oh, which suggests that, you know, even when people choose occupations in a completely anonymous way without any potential social sanction, they do tend to choose the traditional occupation. So that suggests that it might be a positive tie. But in addition to those identity or psychological links, there's a lot of other ties that people might have with their traditional occupations. So for example, people's parents are more likely to have worked in the traditional occupation for their caste. So they've got all that skill that's being passed down through the generations, and that skill tends to be focused on the occupation that was traditional for the caste. Similarly, they've got all their network, all their connections with other caste members. And because castes are, like I said, concentrated in the traditional occupation, those social networks tend to be the strongest in the occupations that are traditional for the castes. So on the one hand, you have kind of the root psychological or root identity links with an occupation. But over time, historically, those links have built up a large number of other connections with the occupation, both through parental skill transmission and parental, you know, ties, as well as through the whole social network. And what's really interesting is that if you imagine a world in which you just got rid of people's sort of psychological or discriminatory attachment with their traditional occupation, they wouldn't necessarily stop working in that occupation because these other ties are there, because they would still have had their parents working in that occupation and still their social networks would be in those occupations. So even if they felt no particular emotional or identity attachment to the occupation, they would still have many reasons, many productivity-based reasons to continue to work in that occupation.
Interestingly, in a paper, you've managed to build a model that takes account of these networks, these ties to particular occupations. But to be able to model the labor market, you do need some data to calibrate your model. Where do you get this data?
So we actually take advantage of several new types of data and several very old types of data. So our paper is really based on linking historical data on these traditional occupations in kind of an early industrial, even a pre-industrial period, with modern day very detailed survey data on people's work and their earnings and their education and lots of other characteristics like that. And the way we do this is we go through a very laborious process of cleaning up and linking these caste names that were listed, say, by the British or by early anthropologists in anthropological or census studies with modern day caste names. So this is challenging, partly because there's names are spelled and written in so many ways, and also because castes have, to some extent, changed the names they use over time. So, historically, you would see a certain caste being referred to, for example, as Ahir, which would be kind of a pastoral caste. And now that same caste would go by a different name, which would be Yadav, just to give a well-known example, as sort of a process through which these castes have evolved over time and have sought to tie themselves to historical sources of prestige for their caste. And so linking them over time is an important challenge. But we managed to do that for over 1,000 castes and can now look in a modern day IHDS survey, which is a conducted which has very detailed caste data, and see for almost every single individual in that survey what their traditional occupation of their caste was historically.
I can imagine how laborious that work must have been. And is the point of it to look at this as its influence on the whole economy. Because when you start to talk about this, as we've been doing so far, we tend to personalize it and think about how individuals respond to the caste system. Are you looking at India's economy as a whole here?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really important because what we find, at least with respect to the direct effect of caste attachments, is that it can have a really big individual effect. That is, my attachment to a particular caste might have a big effect on my own occupational choice. But if we just imagine India's economy just getting rid of those identity attachments, what we find is that it doesn't really change the economic output that much. You know, getting rid of the identity attachments might increase overall output by maybe 0.5% at most. And the reason for that is quite striking. First, it goes back to what I told you earlier, that just getting rid of my sort of emotional or cultural ties with my occupation doesn't significantly decrease how likely I am to do it. Because it still may be, you know, the occupation my father did, or it still may be the occupation that my community is concentrated in. And second, if you think about a lot of these occupations that are very associated with caste, for example, fishing or being in the laundering, washing clothes, that kind of thing, you know, someone needs to do those occupations. Those occupations have an important role in the Indian economy. And if that occupation isn't being done by individuals who sort of traditionally did that occupation, well, it'll be done by someone else. Right. So, you know, even if getting rid of these traditional occupations might decrease the number of clothes washers by, you know, some small fraction, that change in the share of the economy that is devoted to clothes washing is actually not that big and doesn't have a huge aggregate effect on the economy. Now, things are different if we consider getting rid of the other links. That is, if we consider getting rid of the links between occupation through parents and the links of occupation through social network. That's really where we see a larger effect. That, you know, once you break almost all the links with traditional occupation, then you really see much more resorting of individuals and resorting of occupations going on in the economy. What I think was really surprising to us there is that we were thinking that the main role of these links between individuals and occupations would be to sort of distort the economy and to cause it to have less than optimal outcome. But what we found was that once you get rid of these caste occupation-based social networks, aggregate output actually goes down by, you know, a fairly significant amount, at least 5%. And so what it seems like, and, you know, after we made sure that our numbers were correct and that we weren't just making a mistake somewhere, what it seems like is that these traditional occupations have a kind of coordinating role in the economy. You could imagine lots of different social networks. We could all be concentrated in one job, or we could all be concentrated in another job, or people could be doing jobs grouped by caste or not, or something like that. But there's a real high advantage in having social networks in which members of the same caste do the same occupation. And that's because members of the same caste are able to coordinate and cooperate really well because they're all married to each other and they're involved in long-term relationships with each other, which are really good for coordinating. And so you really want all those members of the same caste in the same occupation. And the way traditional occupations benefit the economy in that sense is they coordinate members of the same caste in the same occupation, which leads to substantial productivity gains for those individuals, because now they're kind of working with their community and presumably they're able to sustain higher productivity on their jobs because of that social network effect. So, you know, in a world in which you could imagine many different types of social networks, some better or worse for productivity, the role of traditional occupation is to coordinate castes into a social network that enhances productivity. And once you get rid of that, you actually see a decrease in the aggregate output of the economy.
It suggests that the relationship between the output of the economy and personal choice over which job to do, and then the restrictions or the opportunities that caste provides, it's a lot more complicated than a lot of this would assume. There is also, however, that caste has been traditionally associated with hierarchy, but it's a very nuanced picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in some of our more recent work, we're getting into hierarchy as well. And we do find somewhat larger effects of just getting rid of caste-based discrimination, particularly in education, and particularly in the fact that many traditionally low castes were associated, I think, partially in a discriminatory sense, were forced to do occupations with very low returns to education. So, for example, sanitary work or leather work are all occupations that were associated with low caste, but where the return to education is pretty low. And if we get rid of that discriminatory factor and we get rid of that link, we find that, at least in our data, we would expect those individuals to get more education. And, you know, the intuition is that, look, if you expect that growing up, your only opportunities are going to be in jobs in which there's really a very low return to education, for example, sanitary work, then there's not a very strong incentive to get an education because, you know, you're going to be forced to work in a job or almost forced to work in a job in which there's no return to education. Mm-hmm. So once we get rid of those links between low castes and low status, low returns to education occupations, then we see a substantial increase in the expected education of those low castes and a much larger positive effect on the economy.
For a long time, people have been predicting the demise of the caste system, or at least the weakening of it. And where we are today, in modern India, there are many young Indian students and young workers, they're employed in jobs, or they would like to be employed in jobs, that really didn't exist when this caste system evolved and was created. Is this going to weaken the links between caste and occupation?
I think it will eventually, yes. And even if you look in our data, the links between caste and occupation that we see in the current generation are weaker than they were in the parents' generation. And those, in turn, are weaker than they were in, you know, say, 1911. Mm-hmm. So even though I think gradually over time, those links with what we call the traditional occupations will disappear, I don't think that the role of identity in people's choice of a job is going to disappear. And I think that's something we see around the world, both in the US, UK, and in India as well, that maybe as people's links with their traditional occupations disappear, they'll be replaced with ties with new occupations. So even though that might not be necessarily at the caste level, it might also be at the caste level. And let me give you an example. For example, there's a well-known caste that traditionally worked in pots, making pots and roof tiles. Mm-hmm. But as that occupation disappeared, that caste sort of transitioned and now is concentrated largely in making sort of hand-rolled cigarettes, which is actually a new occupation. Tobacco historically didn't exist in India. We see occupational identities constantly changing and reforming, but maybe not really ever going away. So just as you would imagine, for example, a coal miner who's, you know, the coal mine shuts down and that person would struggle to find an occupation, say, in home health because they really identify themselves with their traditional occupation of mining. I think those types of occupational identity links are a permanent feature of the economy.
Well, it's a fascinating paper, and it certainly made me realize how much that I didn't know about this subject.
Me too.
The results are so counterintuitive.
Absolutely, as well.
Dan, thank you ever so much for talking to me about it today.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed our conversation.
The paper is called A Division of Labourers, Identity and Efficiency in India, and the authors are William Kassan, Daniel Keniston, and Tatiana Kleinerberg. This has been a VoxDev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. And our past episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org, or if you're a subscriber, they're on your phone now.